You again. This time we're not buried in snow. My first trip here, not traveling through the snow. I see what it all looks like now. Well, this morning, what I want us to do is to return to the place where we left off just a few weeks ago when I was with you, maybe nearly a month now, considering the historical significance of Christ's resurrection, and in particular, as we see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I want us to spend the entirety of our time in 1 Corinthians 15. Many of you are familiar with it, and when you think about the doctrine of Christ's resurrection from the dead, this is probably, other than the concluding chapters of the Gospels, one of the first places that you go to discover the meaning and the significance of Christ's resurrection. I'll begin with Paul's own words, reiterating the gospel which he preached, which was a gospel of Christ crucified and raised, the resurrection not a mere appendage, but a crucial element of the gospel itself. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 3, "For I delivered to you as of first importance what I also received, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, and that He was buried, and that He was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." The last time we were together, we considered three passages, really only two in depth, Luke chapter 20, verses 30 to 36, and 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 to 23. The point that we were making at that time was that the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead marks the beginning not merely of a new era in this world, not merely of a new time, as it were, on this historical landscape, but it inaugurates, it brings about the beginnings of a new history that isn't part of this world's history, of this age, from the creation of the world, the creation of Adam, to the consummation of all things when Christ returns in glory and destroys and brings to an end this present age and order of things. What we're considering in the resurrection of Christ is not merely how Christ transforms the passing of events on that plane of reality in which we all currently live and abide, but we're considering even further how the resurrection of Jesus Christ inaugurates a never-ending and eternal order of things, a new world, a new creation, if we can put it that way. Maybe in more familiar terms, the eternal kingdom is inaugurated decisively in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In Luke chapter 20, Christ draws out the contrast between this age and the age to come with that familiar language of the sons of this age and the sons of that age. And he uses just those simple descriptions of this age and that age. And he speaks to us, he speaks of that age as the age of the resurrection. Sometimes in the New Testament, this age is contrasted to the coming age in terms of an ethical contrast. I think particularly of Galatians chapter 1, where he speaks of this present age in verse 4 as us being rescued from this present evil age. In that case, this age, has a decisively negative connotation. When Christ speaks of this age in Luke 20, he seems to be rather neutral about the ethical quality of this age. In fact, in a certain sense, he describes this age as the good things that we all know in this life, particularly marriage in that context. Marriage belongs decisively to this age, not to the age to come, and yet marriage is a good thing. In God's plan and God's intent, this age, though corrupted by sin and on one account could rightly be called an evil age, is also an age full of good things for us richly to enjoy that come from the hand of God. And yet the point in both cases is that this age, whether considered under the good aspect of being married and given in marriage, or whether considered under the evil aspect, as Paul brings out in Galatians chapter 1, this age is a passing age. Not merely that, not merely meaning that time transpires, but that this age is hastening on toward its absolute punctuation, its full stop. This age was not built to last for eternity. In God's original created design, He did not intend in the original creation the permanent and eternal continuation of this present order of things. Even this present order of things under the consideration of good and blessing, even of marriage. These things belong to this age, and this age is passing. We weren't made ultimately to fix our feet in a permanent way in this age. Christ specifically denotes the coming age, or that age, as the age of the resurrection, when we pointed that out. A simple shorthand way to describe the coming age, the eternal age, is the resurrection age. We went from there to consider then how Paul draws this out in respect particularly to Christ's own resurrection. First, we consider the words of Christ and the divisions he makes between this age and the age to come as the age of resurrection. And then we considered, secondly, that Christ himself is the one who has first entered that coming age, that age that will never end. We looked at 1 Corinthians 15, verses 20 to 23. In particular, the fact that Christ has been raised, verse 20, as the first fruits of those who are asleep. The picture is of a harvest, and Christ is the first fruits of the resurrection harvest. We remarked that others had been raised from the dead before Christ raised, and yet they weren't the first fruits, though they were raised before Christ in order of time. They weren't raised into the same kind of resurrection into which Christ was raised. The fact that we easily observe from all of the other resurrections prior to the time of Christ, and even some of those performed at the hands of the apostles after the time of Christ, is that each of those that were raised died again. They weren't raised imperishable and incorruptible. They weren't raised up into glory. They weren't raised up into a new heavenly mode of existence. They were raised up simply to be returned to their existence of this age. They were returned back to the bodily mode of this age existence. When Christ raised from the dead, he can rightly be called the first fruits, not because he's the first to ever come out of the grave, but because he's the first to ever ascend from the grave into the new order of bodily existence that Christ himself in Luke 20 identifies as that age. Not this age, that coming age. Christ himself is the first to enter that coming age, and on entering that coming age in his resurrection, he brings about, if we can think of it chronologically, though I don't want to get into the mental gymnastics of trying to assess what eternal life means chronologically, just simply to say that that never-ending, imperishable mode of existence that is called the resurrection by Christ himself is first entered by Christ on his resurrection, and to date has not been entered by anyone else. So far, as things go, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the inauguration of the eternal kingdom, but Christ himself is the only one who is in that kingdom in its full bodily mode. I make that distinction because there is a real sense in which each of us, if we have trusted Christ, is, as regards our inner man, in that eternal kingdom now in our inner mode, and we will one day join Christ in that outer and bodily mode. But Christ alone is fully in that eternal life, that eternal kingdom. The point that we made simply is this, that Christ's resurrection from the dead, though a distinct and unique event, is, in the scheme of things, redemptively and historically speaking, inseparable, absolutely inseparable from the resurrection of his own. The resurrection of Jesus Christ was not simply an event that happened for you on your behalf, but it was the inauguration of an event of which your own resurrection is a decisive part if you belong to Christ. So the event of Jesus' resurrection is not merely a kind of surd or absurdity in history in which we can say, oh, look, Jesus raised from the dead, it confirms the gospel or something like that. The resurrection of Jesus Christ is not a standalone event, but it is, as it were, the first payment or the down payment or I like to put it this way, the first episode of one single eschatological event that marks the end of this age and the beginning of the eternal age. The point is this, the resurrection from the dead, especially as it's conceived in the Old Testament, I think particularly of Daniel 12, as the resurrection is conceived in the Old Testament, the resurrection is a singular future event. It's a singular future culminative. And when I say eschatological, I don't mean to pull out specialized terms. I simply mean an event that pertains to the culmination of all things, an event that particularly marks the summing up of this age and the beginning of the eternal age. Eschatological means literally last, the study of last things. This is a last and final event in the history of this world that marks the beginning of the end of this world and the beginning of the beginning, if I could put it that way, of an eternal and never-ending world. Christ's resurrection from the dead is, if we can depict it this way, a piece of the future, a piece of the very end of all things, being, as it were, broken off and placed back in history, but not broken off so as to be separated from that general resurrection of the dead that's to follow. The resurrection of the dead that you and I anticipate in Christ, that event is not waiting to begin. That singular event has begun. The first episode has already been aired, as it were. I might liken it to a made-for-TV movie that runs one night and concludes the next night. The unit of the event that we might call the movie or whatever it is may occur in two episodes, but it's an inseparable unit. It's a whole. The event of Christ's resurrection from the dead is not a self-contained unit in history. It is simply a first episode of our own anticipated resurrection. That means that eschatology, the end times, and the beginning of the eternal kingdom have been decisively inaugurated. The end of all things is literally upon us by virtue of Christ's resurrection, and the beginning of things that will never be shaken and never end, the eternal kingdom, is also decisively in place. This is a difficult thing to get our minds around, because this age and that coming age are both in place right now. Both are occurring at this moment. Christ's resurrection then marks the beginning of the age to come that ultimately is designed to displace this present age. And yet the thing that is so perplexing is that there is, if we can think of the earthly timeline and the heavenly timeline, there's an overlap of those two timelines. Two histories, but with a distinctive overlap in time. If we have time, we'll say more about what that means in terms of our own personal experience of union with Christ as resurrected. Because in a real sense, we have been attached to Christ in his heavenly mode of existence, and yet we continue here in this, our own earthly and fleshly and decaying mode of existence. So that both modes are present together at the same time. And in a certain sense, both modes aren't simply present together at the same time historically, but both modes are present together at the same time in our own experience of salvation. So that if you have a saving interest in Christ and have been attached to him, you have already become a citizen of the eternal kingdom. Your citizenship, your home is already there, and yet in a very real sense, even as on a day when many of us are probably thinking about politics in our nation and what's going to happen, we still have an interest in what happens here in this age. We still have a citizenship here. We feel the tension of that in our Christian lives, and yet the nature of the resurrection as being a resurrection of two episodes, Christ and ours to follow in order, is precisely the historical event or happening that creates this kind of tension for the Christian. I don't say that it's an unholy tension. I simply say that it puts the Christian with a foot in this world, as it were, and a foot in the world to come, and we are to live responsibly in both at one and the same time. If we can put it this way, if we say that this is creation, an absolute starting point, and here is the history of creation until the time of Christ on the cross. Shortly after the cross, Christ ascends to glory in resurrected body, at that moment, a new creation history, as it were, has a new decisive beginning, a new order of things, an eternal kingdom begins. All the while, this present temporal passing age, whether you consider that as good or bad, goes on. And we're in it. And yet at the same time, our citizenship papers have been transferred here. And yet we still haven't given up the papers of this earth. I think of it, if that's troublesome, I might just illustrate it this way. The Apostle Paul, who probably more than anyone gives exposition to this notion of our heavenly citizenship, very frequently made use of the advantages of his own earthly citizenship. His privileges, and again, don't think that it's somehow ungodly or unholy to use your privileges here in this pre-resurrected order of things, this age. We're not necessarily to despise this age in as much as this age is still a good age in which good things from the Lord are designed for us and given to us. Even the Apostle Paul makes free and liberal use of this. In fact, sometimes he has privileges that other Christians don't have because of his Roman citizenship that they didn't enjoy. It's not some mark of super spirituality for him to resign those privileges of citizenship. But rather, he understands that the Christian's life is lived with a foot planted here on this earth and also in the eternal glory, which will never end. This earthly history from creation to the consummation has a full stop. The new creation, if we can just denote it with an N and a C, that new creation has a decisive beginning in the resurrection of Christ, but it's a creation and an order of things that will never be shaken and never end. There is no full stop in that order of things. Christ is said to be the first fruits of this in as much as he is the first one in terms of his full existence, inner and outer man, to enter into this mode of existence. In doing that, he inaugurates a history that is decisively not rooted on this plane of things in which we live. And yet we live on here, attached to Christ who is there setting our minds on things above, all the while living faithfully to the calling of this kingdom as we seek to be faithful also in this kingdom on earth. That is, if I can say it in a nutshell, I'll get ahead of myself and then bring us up to speed from the text. That is, in a sense, precisely what the notion of already and not yet, I know that you have studied that here, that is precisely what already and not yet means for you internally as a Christian. The already and not yet of your existence locates you in heaven and on earth at the same time. The not yet side of your salvation leaves you working out your salvation with fear and trembling in this plane. The already says that you have been raised up and even glorified. Past accomplished tense, Paul says, you have already been seated with Christ on his throne. Already have been, Ephesians 2. These are almost unfathomable realities for us as believers, to think that our life is lived here and there at one and the same moment and one and the same time. In fact, probably so overwhelming was this thought that some in Corinth simply did away with such a notion. Paul is confronting in 1 Corinthians 15 those who say that there is no resurrection from the dead. If we have received the Spirit, then what need have we any longer of a body? And yet, something that needs to be pointed out about these two orders of things, both of these are bodily physical orders. Though this is spiritual and this is natural, we'll look at that language in our text, both are bodily, both are physical. The spiritual in our passage this morning, looking at verses 35 through 49, the spiritual is not anti-matter, anti-physical. That's a Greek and a pagan notion that had gotten in the minds of some Christians, and I think sometimes even today might still affect the way we think about spirituality. Spirituality is made, in the language of the apostle in the latter half of 1 Corinthians 15, spirituality is made out to be decisively and pointedly physical and bodily. This is something that the ethereal, esoteric notion of spirituality can't process. So let's follow the apostle's argument through the last part of 1 Corinthians 15, I want to look particularly at verses 35 to 49. We're going to move very quickly through verses 35 to 41, simply because we were there last time, but it's good if we just make mention of it again. Consider with me verse 35. And first of all, Paul points out the difference between kinds of bodies. Again, the question is the resurrection. He's going to ultimately bring us, right now he's talking about our own resurrection. The question of resurrection at all, is such a thing possible? And what would a resurrection from the dead look like? He begins by a contrast of kinds of bodies. Verse 35, he entertains the possible opposition. But someone will say, how are the dead raised? First opposition. And secondly, with what kind of body do they come? Paul leaves the first question aside for a moment. He's going to come to that later. And he picks up this question, with what kind of body do they come? The absurdity is, look, this is my body. How could this body possibly be resurrected? And if I came back and, you know, if I came into the resurrected mode of body, wouldn't that decisively obliterate this body? Questions like this. And Paul goes on to open up for them the fact that each body is made by God and is suited. And again, this language is important. It's difficult. It's somewhat subtle, but it's important. Each body is made and designed by God in a way and a manner that is suitable to fill the place God has designed and intended for it. And he goes on, he starts out very simply, giving us illustrations. Moving to verse 37, and that which you sow, you do not sow the body which is to be, but a bare grain, perhaps of wheat or something else. But God gives it a body just as he wished. Again, we get this notion of God's intentionality, just as he wished, and each of the seeds a body of its own. His point is this. If the question is with what kind of body are we raised, let's just step back and very generally and broadly consider, first of all, that God very purposefully designs different kind of bodies for different creatures that are suitable to their own order and place in his creation and his design. Verses 36 and 37, he begins with a consideration of the plant world. And then he goes on in verse 39 to mention animal life. Verse 39, all flesh is not the same. First, he begins with plant life, verses 36 to 38. Verse 39, he brings in animal life. All flesh is not the same, but there is one flesh of men, another flesh of beasts, another flesh of birds, another flesh of fish. There's a great variety of bodies among different species of animals, and each is appropriate to its intended order. Man occupies a place in this creation, and he is given a body suitable to the place God intends for him to occupy. An animal, a fish, a four-footed animal, a fish, a bird, all of these things are given bodies that are suitable to filling their place in the order of things as God intends them. Their bodies are fitted and fashioned in a way that is appropriate to their manner of existence. A fish has scales. He can swim. A bird doesn't do so well in the water because he wasn't designed to live in the water. God, in creation, God fits bodies to match the order of creation and the place of that thing in the order. This is going to become, I'll give you a preview of why Paul is going through all of these things. He's trying to bring to our mind the fittingness of each body for its place in creation, because in a few moments, he's going to broach the subject of a new creation. And the question of our own bodily existence in that creation is going to come up. And it's important that we understand, simply by looking around us in this world, that God is the kind of God who purposefully, after his own intention and will, designs the body to be suitable for the place he intends for it to inhabit. And if he intends for us to inhabit this order of things with its punctuated beginning and its punctuated ending, then he gives us a body suited to earthly existence. And if he intends for us to be translated from earthly existence to heavenly existence in a bodily form, then with what kind of body do they come? They come with a body suited to the manner of existence God intends for them. The resurrection is a translation of your manner of existence, a movement, as it were. You leave your original created manner of existence and you take on a new created manner of existence. Sometimes Paul just calls this the new creation. When he talks about the new creation, he's not simply talking about new thoughts and affections in our hearts, though that's certainly a part of it in the already, but there's also a not yet of the new creation in which we will be translated decisively and permanently out of the old creation and into the new, bodily. And when that happens, with what kind of body will you be raised? You'll be raised with a body that is just as God wishes, suitable to the place in that creation. Well, that we'll have to consider what kind of creation then is that? And what kind of body would I need in that creation? What is that new order of things? And what kind of body is suited to that new order of things? All these questions are coming up, and he's going to bring our attention to Christ in a few moments. Now, he's made all the distinction of plants and animals, and then in verse 42, he brings the attention to man, and he says, even among human flesh, there are different kinds of bodies. Even among human flesh, we can discern all the different kinds of bodies relative to animals and plants, birds and fish. And yet, even within the human order, even among Homo sapiens, there's not simply one flat view of what it means to live in the body. Now, you've only experienced one mode of bodily existence so far. But yet, that is not, and as we see in these few examples, these antitheses that the apostle sets out, that's not the only mode of existence that God has designed and intended for you. Verse 40 and 41. And I didn't mention this. I jumped to verse 42. Verse 40 and 41 leave the earthly sphere, but we're still in this created order. When he moves to considering heavenly bodies in verses 40 and 41, don't think of the apostle as moving up into this heavenly sphere of new creation. He's still talking about this created order. This line that I've drawn here is to represent not only the earth, but all the planets and the luminaries and things that surround the earth. This present age, this present order of things. There are also heavenly bodies and earthly bodies. The sun wouldn't do so well on earth. Rivers wouldn't do so well on Mars. You can see that the bodies and the shapes of things, the things that he creates, are suitable to the place he intends for them. The glory of the heavenly is one. The glory of the earthly is another. There is one glory of the sun, another glory of the moon, and another glory of the stars. And even among the stars, star differs from star, so that not the glory of every star, the glory of its burning existence as a ball of gas or whatever a star is. Some of you paid better attention than I did in astronomy. But whatever a star is, each star is designed for maybe a slightly different purpose. Some stars, as in our solar system, the center of our solar system is a great star. But stars, not every star is the center of its own solar system. So some stars are suited in their body, in their mass, in their density, in their gravitational pull, in the lumens they send forth, all the things that go into being a star. Every star is fitted for the order in which God intends for it to reflect His glory. It's crucial that we get a sense of the sovereignty of God over all aspects of bodily existence, not just human bodies, but heavenly, plant, animal, etc. And then even among interspecies bodies, there are different bodies suited for different purposes in the created order. Now, he brings the contrast finally to verse 42 between men. Not even all human bodies are the same. So also is the resurrection of the dead. Now, this so also is grabbing everything from verse 36 to 41. He's reaching back there. I hope we have this in place, the order of bodies. So also the resurrection of the dead. It's just like this with the resurrection of the dead. God has an intended order for things. He suits bodies for that order. It is sown a perishable body. It is raised an imperishable body. It's sown in a manner corresponding to existence on this plane, and it's raised in a manner corresponding to existence in the new creation. Sown perishable, raised imperishable. Sown, verse 43, in dishonor, raised in glory. Again, dishonor on this plane of things because of the entrance of sin, glory in the new creation. And then finally, a third contrast, it's sown in weakness, again, weakness on account of sin, raised in power. That is to say, raised in a manner of existence that cannot be cut down by death, that cannot be destroyed, that cannot be cut short, as our life in this order is. Now, he has a fourth contrast that he brings out in verse 44, but I'm going to save that for a moment because he does something subtly different between verses 43 and 44. In verses 42 and 43, the contrast, the three contrasts of pre-resurrected body and resurrected body, is a contrast between our body as under the aspect and corrupting power of sin. You get that, right? It's perishable, it's dishonorable, and it's weak. Folks, that's not how Adam lived in the garden prior to sin. Every one of those features of the body is in a certain sense deformed in this order with the entrance of sin. With the entrance of sin brings on a corrupting power on the body that was fitted for this order. So that now, if I can put it this way, and I'm going to open this up for us in just a moment. So now, instead of simply one day, and I'll try to confirm this interpretation, instead of simply one day being translated from this order to the God's intended heavenly and never-ending order by some supernatural transformation of the body, man does not simply move along until the point of culminating obedience is translated into that new and eternal kingdom, but rather man must die. Rather than passing into the new and the eternal and the heavenly and the spiritual age, rather than passing out of this good age to that eternal and better and lasting age, even the good age was not intended for eternity. Instead of simply passing that way, man must die. So now there's an added contrast to the bodies between the two orders. No longer is it simply a contrast between the body of this age and the body of that age. There's an additional contrast. The body of this age has a distinct corrupting influence upon it that drags it down to the grave. So the apostle contrasts the body of this age, and we might even think in these two verses of the present passing evil age. He thinks of this age as passing and the body that's appropriate to this present evil age as corruptible, perishable, dishonorable, weak, in contrast to the body that is going to be suited for that eternal age. Now, the point I want to make about the order of bodies, before we go to consider verse 44, is simply this. The movement that takes place in verses 42 and 43 from one kind of body to another is not simply a movement that takes place within this one framework of history. It's a movement that moves us out of this realm of history, out of this age, and moves us into the age to come. So that the importance of resurrection is not simply getting back to the garden, as it were. It's not simply getting back to a better way of living in this age, but its resurrection is actually designed to have historical consequences for each person that's raised, because it's an event that translates us out of this age. The resurrection is not getting back to the garden. The resurrection is getting into the new and eternal age. It's getting us into that mode of existence to which the garden pointed as an earthly picture and a type and a symbol. How many trees of life are in the Garden of Eden? One. How many are in the New Jerusalem? They line the streets. They grow on either side of the river. The tree of life. Not one tree of life, many trees of life. The garden is a little piece of this eschatological eternal age, as it were, broken off and imaged forth down here in time at the beginning for man to have, as it were, a foretaste for a while, to plant his foot, to enjoy the good things, to aspire by his obedience, to be translated out of this order of things into that eternal, never-ending order, to be translated from the mode of one tree of life to many trees of life, if I can put it that way. Adam sees in the garden the decisive picture of something profoundly and infinitely more wonderful than the garden. And that's not to say that the garden lacked. The garden was wonderful. The garden was good. in every way, but good only to the extent that it was intended to be a pleasant accommodation for Adam as he traversed through the course of obedience to obedience and finally to glory. Adam doesn't start in glory, but he doesn't start in sin either. Adam starts good and upright and must remain that way by virtue of his own obedience, and he fails. Adam never gets to glory. Adam doesn't fall from eschatological glory to sin. Adam falls from probation to sin. Adam never was in eschatological glory. Okay, that's the contrast. And I only make this point. I want to make the historical point. The resurrection is not simply something that takes place and changes things for us within this framework of history. It propels us out of this whole framework of history into a new history, which is the eternal kingdom, the new creation. I say that because of imperishability in verse 42. Adam was not imperishable. Adam prior to sin was not subject to decay, but neither was his body imperishable. How do I know? He wasn't subject to decay until sin entered in, and yet once sin entered in, he was perishable, which is to say that his body had the capacity to be corrupted if sin should enter. Adam wasn't in an imperishable body. 42, sown in dishonor, raised in glory. Glory, and I'm not going to open it up because we have a few more things to say. Glory is an eschatological term. Glory denotes the eternal mode of existence. I'm only going to make reference to Daniel chapter 12, a key Old Testament passage on the resurrection. Verse 2, many of those who sleep in the dust of the ground will awake, these to everlasting life, but others to disgrace and everlasting contempt. I make one note there. Those that are raised that aren't going to heaven aren't raised to life. Just make that point. That's not life that they receive in that resurrection. Anyway, on to verse 3. Those who have insight, this is talking about those that will awake unto everlasting life, verse 3 of Daniel 12. Those who have insight will shine brightly like the brightness of the expanse of heaven, and those who lead the many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. Glory is the mode of bodily resurrection that is eternal, that's suited for this new creation, that's suited for the forever and ever creation, is a glorious body. How do I know that there are historical and eschatological contrasts going on in 1 Corinthians 15, 42, and 43? Imperishable body, glorious body, powerful body. All of those things denote a mode of bodily existence that no one, not even pre-fallen Adam, ever experienced in this framework of history. Those things all belong to the age to come. Okay, verse 44, a different contrast. In this, we move from a soulish order to a spiritual order. What the apostle does is he drops, it's strange, he keeps up the contrast in verse 44. It is sown a natural body, literally, and I think more helpfully, that should be translated soulish body. It is sown a soulish body, it is raised a spiritual body. Both are physical bodies. And then the apostle stops the contrast altogether, and he moves to a whole different kind of construction of argument. And this is I don't know if you've read this in your devotions, you're reading through 1 Corinthians 15, you come to verse 44, and the apostle starts saying things as if they're points of logic, and they're a little bit hard to understand. Sometimes very hard to understand. Look at what he does at the second half of verse 44. The antithetical contrast that's been going on since verse 42 drops away, and he inserts instead an if-then statement. Verse 44, if there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. We're still seeing two orders of body, but the contrast is gone, and now he's arguing in a different way altogether. He's saying, if this, then this. And you think to yourself, well, how do I know that if a natural body related to this order, how do I know that if this, then this? It makes this sound unconditional in a certain sense. It makes it sound like if there is this mode of existence, there is most certainly to follow this mode of existence, as though that's readily apparent. But it's not readily apparent. And so the apostle brings in a scriptural argument in his defense. And the argument is not, the argument is not immediately and abundantly clear, at least not to us in our present context. I think it might have certainly been for the Corinthians, because they're already tracking with the apostles' mode of this age, that age, this present evil age, the age of the Spirit. They're already kind of in the groove, as it were, with the apostles. Sometimes it's difficult for us to come to that. He quotes in verse 45, this is his explanation at the end of verse 44, if the natural body or soulish body, then a spiritual body. So also it is written. Well, let's have textual proof. And he quotes for us Genesis 2:7. The first man, Adam, became a living soul. Okay, the soul there corresponds to natural. It's the same word. Became soulish. When did Adam become soulish? Adam became a living soul at the moment in which God drew him from the dust of the ground and breathed life into him. The last Adam, literally the eschatos Adam, the eschatological Adam, the first Adam became a living soul. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. Your English translation probably inserts a quotation after living soul. The Greek doesn't do anything like that. The Greek, as it were, begins with a scriptural citation. The first man, Adam, became a living soul. It begins with a scriptural citation, but then it actually strings the next statement on as though it were intended to be understood from the scriptural statement, so that the scriptural statement naturally implies that the last Adam would become a life-giving spirit. Why would that be the case? The contrast, anyway, let me just step back and say one thing. The contrast here is not between Adam in sin. It's between Adam created in this order of things. It's between Adam created from the dust of the ground and Christ, let me say this, created again by the Spirit by the resurrection from the dead. What's being contrasted is two beginnings of two men. Two creations are being set in contrast, and these two creations correspond to two epochs or eons or orders of existence. This is the apostle begins to open up our consideration of what resurrection means here. The first man became a living soul. When did Adam become a living soul? He became a living soul at the moment God breathed life into him. Genesis 2:7. It's talking about the absolute creation of Adam. Adam stands at the head of a created order of things. It's a created order of things that's not intended to last. It's a soulish order, not a spiritual order. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. This is an interesting question then. When did Christ, taking Christ to be the last Adam, the second Adam, the eschatological Adam, when did Christ become life-giving spirit? At his resurrection. But what is the coordination going on in the mind of the apostle? Adam stands at the head in virtue of being breathed into and being made soulish. Adam stands at the head of this age and this order of things. We're not talking about ethical issues here. We're just talking about God intending a good and temporal order of things. Adam stands at the head of one creation, but he stands at the head of that creation in a manner not fitted to last for eternity. He stands at the head of that creation in a finite mode of body, in a mode of body not suited for the very thing to which the garden pointed him. The very thing that was held out for him as the reward of his obedience, the very thing that all the blessings of the garden, and particularly the tree of life, would have extended to Adam, he is in a body not suited to actually live in the order to which the garden pointed. He's in a soulish mode of body. Does Adam know that he's in a perishable mode of body? I don't say perishing because he hasn't sinned yet, but does Adam know in the garden he's in a temporal, non-eternal mode of body? Yes, he does, because the Lord promises him and assures him by his very word, in the day you eat thereof, you will surely die. Adam knows before the fall that he is not in a mode of body suited to last for all of eternity. He is not in a glorious, imperishable, and powerful mode of bodily existence, even before the fall. That doesn't mean that he was in a dishonorable, weak, or perishable mode either. It simply means that he was not in, if I can draw us up here, in an eschatological mode at that point. If Adam is a soulish body, then we must look for a spiritual body, because we all know, Adam knew, you ought to know, that the soulish body isn't built to last for all of eternity. It's not the body of the eternal kingdom. It's the body of the earthly kingdom from which we shove off into eternity by virtue of obedience, and which we failed to shove off because of Adam's disobedience, in which Christ comes as the second Adam, and Christ effects this movement, our arrow here. Adam should have effected it. He didn't. He sinned and we die. Christ, dead and raised, actually succeeds where Adam fails and moves us into that order of body. The logic is, Adam's soulish. Obviously, Adam himself knew that he was not built to last. We ought to know. And yet, the created order pointed to a lasting and more permanent and glorious order, and that promise was held out by virtue of obedience, if you obey. And yet he failed to attain those things. That's the logic of the apostle. The two orders of existence. The two Adams stand as two men at the beginning of two creations. The one of this creation, not destined to last. The second of this creation, built to last and perishable, and glorious and powerful. Verse 47 says that the first man is from the earth, earthy. The second man is from heaven. I'm reading the New American Standard. I don't know what your translation says. If it says from is probably not the most helpful translation of that. Literally, it just says the first man is of earth. That simply does. It's not talking about his origins. It's not talking about his origins. It's talking about his order. It's not talking about his beginnings. It's talking about his quality. Forget for a moment the notion of where he came from. Just simply consider what he is. What is he? He's earthy. That is to say, he lives in a mode of body suited to exist somewhere between here and here, but he's not in a mode of body suited to exist here, even without sin. That was something he would not attain to except through continued righteousness in which he failed. The first man stands at the head of this creation, not the permanent, eternal creation God intends. By obedience, he could get there, but he doesn't. He's earthy. The second man is from heaven. Literally, the second man, heavenly, of heaven. That's not to say that Christ, and again, we're talking about them as they are in their bodies, spiritual body and natural body. Christ is of heaven, not in the sense that the reference here is not saying that the one man came from the earth and the second man came to the earth from heaven. The point is saying that the one man, as Adam, stands in a mode appropriate to this order, and the second man, as second Adam, as eschatological Adam, stands as resurrected in a mode of body corresponding to this order of things. Lastly, he points us to our own nature, and he returns to the question of our own resurrection. The historical importance of Christ's resurrection is that Christ's resurrection is as the first man of a new creation. If we are going to enter that mode of existence, it will only be through union with Christ. You enter this mode of existence through union with that first man, Adam. You enter this mode of existence through union with that second first man, as it were, that second and last Adam who stands at the head of a new creation by union with him. If Adam is your head here, if you want to enter this mode of existence, then Christ must be your head here. And if Christ is your head here by faith, then your own existence will be heavenly. Verse 48. As is the heavenly, so also are those. As is the earthy, so also are those who are earthly. And as is the heavenly, so also are those who are heavenly. Just as we have borne the image of the earthly, and you have borne the image of the earthly, you have been born into a soulish existence. Let me say, in addition to that, Christ himself was born into a soulish existence. Christ bore the image of Adam as a son of Adam, and he bore it in a soulish manner, but he traded that through death, through the putting off of that mode of body and the putting on of the new mode of body. I'm not talking about numerically different bodies, but rather a transformation of his body. Through that, he enters into the heavenly mode. We have borne the image of the earthly. Adam's image is in us as living souls. By faith, Christ's image is in us, and we are translated from citizenship as earthly Adamites to heavenly Christians. This is the significance of Christ's resurrection historically. And it's what it means for you historically. I will consider how we should go forward from this point. It might be worth our time in a future time together, as the Lord gives us opportunity to consider precisely what this reality means more specifically in terms of your internal and now present relation to Christ as raised. Christ is raised, and you have already been raised up with Christ, and yet you still long to be raised up with Him. Where exactly does that leave you between the heavenly and the earthy? I think that's a question that we should consider at another time. Bow with me if you would.